This is the conferencing coordinator. I'd like to advise all parties this conference is now being recorded. Should you have any objections, please disconnect. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to the Charm 10 for August. We have a terrific talk today. Dr. Larry Soderblom is joining us. He's an interdisciplinary scientist with the Cassini Mission and works for the United States Geological Survey and has done quite a bit of work in his career on the large moon of Saturn, Titan, and today he'll be telling us about that. Just a reminder to the participants, *6 is what you can press to mute and unmute your phone because of the capability of your phone, so that's a handy feature. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Soderblom.
Okay, thank you, Trina. This is a lecture that I gave on the 31st of July, just a month ago. It's a lab-wide talk at JPL on this subject, and Trina asked me to give the same talk today. So if you were in attendance of that talk, you might want to find something else to do. I have included all of the slides from that talk, even though many of you are experts on Cassini, having heard many talks through these telecons. But you're welcome to cannibalize these talks for your own use, and so I included all of the slides for that reason. Also, there are a number of movies that are on the website that I've included that are not actually in the talk, but they were on my laptop. You're welcome to use those in any fashion you like. They're all there. So with that, let's. There are 54 time steps in this, and I'll try to keep remarking as to which time step we're on so you can follow along. There are also two very large movies that Trina mentioned, produced by Eric Karkushka at the from the DISR team at the University of Arizona, which are included and embedded in the talk. I won't actually go through those movies. They're 9 minutes each, and they have very fine soundtracks over them. And you're welcome to use those and perhaps view them after the talk. But in the interest of saving time, let's do that offline. All right, so the subject of the talk, Titan and an Earth-like alien, I think the most remarkable thing that we keep finding out is that even though Titan is such an alien environment in terms of its chemistry and temperature, the more and more we look at the geology of Titan, the more it starts to look like a glossary out of the textbook of geological geomorphology of the Earth. And so, which is very striking for those of us that expected such a bizarre and alien landscape. So let's go to the second slide. These are the this is the obligatory cultural slide. The two individuals for which the Huygens probe and the Cassini spacecraft were named. Next slide shows the Cassini spacecraft on the left with the Huygens probe attached to it, and the Huygens probe being assembled on the right. Again, these are general slides for your use. The next slide reminds us that we arrived in mid-July or 1st of July in 2004, mid-2004. And spent several orbits preparing for the release of the probe on Christmas Day 2004, and then encounter impact with the upper atmosphere of Titan by the Huygens probe occurred on January the 14th, 2005, so about a year and a half ago. Next slide. So, reminding you that Titan is a large object. It's larger than Mercury. It has a nitrogen atmosphere like the Earth. Its nitrogen atmosphere is actually four times as dense as the Earth, owing to the fact that its surface pressure is 1.5 times greater, and the temperature is a factor of several times lower. The surface temperature is the order of 90 to 95-96 Kelvin, probably a small variation over the globe. Also, Titan's atmosphere is known to be rich in hydrocarbons. We measured methane in the atmosphere as the probe descended. It was known to exist there. It varied from about 2% at high altitude to the order of 5% in the troposphere. And then, as the probe set on the surface, methane issued out of the subsurface, reaching even higher vapor pressures. So methane is a key to what we expected, and as you know, we were wondering whether the probe would go splash or splut or tinkle. And so the splash was for those that hoped that we might actually land in a methane lake or sea. As you know, we landed on something more like soft sand, and but the methane and ethane in combination on Titan act like water does on the Earth. In other words, it's a ingredient which is mobile as a gas, a liquid, and even as ice particles in clouds and snow in parts of Titan. But we expected to see perhaps methane rain, perhaps methane rivers, perhaps methane lakes and seas. We'll get back to those later. So the methane is also known early on to be converted to a whole range of hydrocarbons due to exposure to ultraviolet photochemistry in the upper atmosphere, converting it to higher order hydrocarbons and combining it with nitrogen to form nitrogen compounds or nitriles, sometimes including things like cyanogen and cyanide-based materials. So in addition to methane rain, we expected a whole host of coatings of black to brown to yellow, orange hydrocarbons snowing down out of the atmosphere. Going to the next slide, which is slide six, lists some of these. This is a slide I got from Jonathan Lunin, and it shows that these compounds that are converted from methane, which is CH4, are quite a wide variety. Ethane is the only one that is a liquid and is miscible with methane, and might well be found in methane-ethane liquids on the surface in these lakes, putative lakes and rivers and so forth. Most of the other materials are solids, acetylene, propane, the cyanide-based compounds, and we might expect a small amount of carbon dioxide on the surface as well. Going to the next slide. So the difficulty, of course, all the way back to Voyager, is seeing through the atmosphere to the surface analyses of Voyager images just a few years ago by a number of folks at the U of A showed that there were subtle features that might actually be visible. But for the most part, we had not seen the surface until Earth-based Hubble Space Telescope images and near-infrared images started to reveal features on the surface. So as a result, Cassini-Curie, an imaging radar, and near-infrared spectrometer, which is called VIMS, Visual Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, and of course the DISSER probe, which floated down through this hazy atmosphere, was able to image the surface. And I've been privileged to be a team member of all three of those teams, the radar team, the VIMS team, and the Huygens DISSER team, and that's the basis of the talk today that I'll be talking about, in combination, all three of those data sets. So in addition to the fact that it has a thick atmosphere and difficult to see through, it also has a thick atmosphere that makes it ideal for visiting the surface by spacecraft. It's probably one of the easiest targets to get a spacecraft to the surface. The surface It's cold, unlike Venus, and which is, although a thick atmosphere, the surface temperature is about what you'd expect if when your modern oven is in a self-clean mode. And that's tough on electronics. The Huygens probe was able to survive more than 2 hours owing to this benign environment, and it actually probably lasted somewhat longer, although the Cassini spacecraft basically flew out of radio contact. So in addition to the atmosphere and its interaction with rain and clouds and rivers, there we expect internal processes as well, tectonism, and what's the basis for that? We believe that there's a lot of ammonia available in the interior of Titan, and that will mix with water to form a hydrate, lowering the melting temperature of water ice from 273 to about 171 Kelvin. And so this by Titan standards, this is extremely hot material. Remember, the surface temperature is the order of 95 Kelvin. So when this lava-like material, this ammonia water hydrate, erupts onto the surface, it would form a gelatinous, gooey mass that would march across the surface in a almost revolting sort of a mode. And so that's another thing we expect to see, and in fact, some of the DISR images suggest that we might actually be seeing some of this ammonia water volcanism, and the VIMS team has also published a paper suggesting there might actually be a cryovolcano of that material. The next slide, which is time step 9, shows three beautiful images provided by the VIMS team, work of Jason Barnes at the University of Arizona. And you see the equatorial belt of Titan is basically remarkably similar in appearance to the dark equatorial belt of Mars. As a matter of fact, if you look in detail at a number of the margins, these sort of serrated, jagged edges between the bright and dark terrain suggested perhaps wind stripping. And in fact, later images that I'll show you suggest there's a wide variety of aeolian processes active in addition to the fluvial processes we see on Titan. Next slide shows the radar coverage as it was being built up over the course of the last couple of years. TA, which is at high latitudes. By the way, I should remark that in the equatorial belt, I noted that it was a dark band around the equator, with the exception that it's interrupted by a very bright region called Xanadu, known from the Earth for a long time. At about 90 degrees longitude, you can see in this region, and we'll come back to Xanadu in that. But TA was our first pass, and it was at fairly high north latitude. If you look at slide 11, you'll see that we numerous features that the radar team interpreted to be related to tectonism and volcanism. And remember, the volcanism we're talking about here is this cryovolcanism involving materials that are the order of 80 degrees hotter than the surface itself. The image on in the center tier on the left is a large pancake dome, very similar to those that we see on Venus, the order of 150 kilometers across. These show patterns throughout them, radial patterns and so forth, suggesting a volcanic flow. The feature in the center reminded me of the groove terrains on that we see in particular on Ganymede, but in the outer solar system icy satellites. These are tectonic patterns produced by a variety of extensional processes involving injections of volcanic material along fault planes. And So volcanism and technism was the key. The slide on the right was dubbed CC the Cat by Charles Alachi on the first day we saw this. And it was our first suggestion that we might be seeing things that were dark enough that there might actually be liquids there. On further inspection, these are still quite bright compared to what we'd expect, and we'll come back to that a bit later. But so far, we've not seen anything in the equatorial or mid-latitude regions that convinced us that we're actually seeing liquids on the surface. On the next slide, we go back to looking at the radar coverage, and T3, which is just south of TA, was the next pass, and slide 13 shows yet a different set of processes. So we had tectonism and volcanism in the TA pass. In the T3 pass, we see on the leftmost side what we interpret to be longitudinal dunes. These turned out later, and I'll show you another slide shortly, to be pervasive throughout the equatorial region. And they are dark, and a key feature to remember here is the dark longitudinal dunes are the one thing that is visible in radar and in the imaging system, in the VIM spectrometer, and in the DISR instrument. And that's going to be important when we come back to how we actually located the DISR landing site. So on the leftmost side, you see those what we call tiger scratches, but they're longitudinal dunes, material which is very fine grain relative to the 2.1 centimeter wavelength of the radar, and so they appear dark as the radar basically vanishes within them. The feature in the center is a very large impact structure, this one about 400 kilometers across, and we've seen a number of impact features. There's another one in the upper right corner of the full radar swath that's shown at the top of the slide called SINLAP. And remember that, we'll come back to that feature as well. And then on the rightmost part of the enlargement in slide 13, you see what look like fluvial or river valleys. These are similar to the kind of crisscrossing fluvial patterns that we see in the deserts of the Earth, and we'll come back to those. So from the first two passes, we saw tectonism, volcanism, impact dunes, and something that looked like drainage patterns. Next slide is slide 14. This has an animation attached, which is a release of the probe, which is in the directory. And so on Christmas Day, the probe was released, and the next slide, slide 15, shows the stages of descent on the multiple sets of parachutes as this as the probe was released and encountered the atmosphere, and then spent a couple of hours, 2.5 hours, in fact, down to descent. And as shown in the slide there, we continued to receive the radio signal for over 3 hours, and the spacecraft probably survived even longer than that. So, next slide shows the a schematic diagram of the probe, and what I want to talk about here is the descent imaging spectral radiometer. This is a remarkable instrument provided by the University of Arizona. Marty Tomasco is the principal investigator, and it has upward-looking and downward-looking ultraviolet spectrometers, infrared spectrometers, visible spectrometers, nephelometers, sun trackers. It's quite a gold mine of, I think it has 14 optical channels, and most of them all worked, providing a whole variety of data sets. The one I'll talk about today are depicted there of the three imaging systems, which take views. Head-looking imager looks out toward the horizon. The medium-resolution imager down at about 45, and the high-resolution imager about 6 degrees off of nadir is the bottom edge of that image. So these three cameras are fired simultaneously in what we call triplets. And as the probe spun, the idea was to collect panoramas as this set of triplets basically marched around as the probe rotated. Well, the next slide, slide 17, shows that the descent was far more complex than we had anticipated. The direction of the probe actually started out and reversed, and to this day, no one really understands how that could be. The vanes which produced the rotation were certainly mounted in the right direction. It turns out that because of the reverse rotation and because of the low signal, DISR lost track of the sun, and so also the wind speeds we expected moved the probe at a fairly high rate across the surface of Titan were much lower than we expected, so the probe basically sank almost vertically down in the lower part of the atmosphere when the surface became visible. And then the wind check direction actually reversed in the last 7 kilometers before landing. The parachute was randomly tilting and experiencing all kinds of chaotic motion. And so when we got our data set the first evening, out of 6 degrees of freedom, which would be the latitude, longitude, elevation, and then the orientation, the three orientation angles, we basically only knew the altitude. So the next slide, which is slide 18, shows something you've all seen, which is the high-resolution mosaic from DISR. And as I said, because the wind speeds were quite low, these mosaics, as we flew closer and closer to the surface, covered the same area. And there's good and bad in that. And the bad in that is we saw less total area with the imaging system. The good in that is that we get higher and higher resolution data of the same region, allowing us to better interpret what we're seeing as we go down to higher resolution. The next slide shows how we went about early on reconstructing the motion of the spacecraft from the images alone. You can see the little mosaic are made up of the high-resolution images taken in the last, looks like 6 to 9 minutes of descent. And we know that, as I said, the bottom edge of the high-resolution imager is 6 degrees off of nadir if the probe were hanging plumb. However, we know the probe was not hanging plumb, and so those little black arrows show where the intercept of the axis of the probe is with the ground. And so by building up mosaics, we can see the direction the spacecraft was moving and the oscillations that it was experiencing, and actually build up a motion history and a directional history. And so you can see that red vector that you get from minus 544 seconds to minus 386 seconds gives us the direction of motion. That little mosaic is dropped into the big mosaic in the lower right corner, and you can see that in the last several minutes the probe was traveling back toward the northwest. Now the prevailing winds through most of the descent was from west to east, and so the next slide shows then the construction of the final part of the trajectory. As I said, it was coming down, traveling to the east, and when it encountered apparently a boundary layer about 7 kilometers, you can see on that scale on slide 20, the wind actually reversed and moved back to the east and or to the west and actually to the north. Now, there are actual meridional winds. Tucano has modeled some of these, and they're tidally induced, and these are not totally unexpected. But they were at the time to us, particularly when we were trying to build a model of the descent trajectory. So the next two time steps are these two movies. In the first movie, they're wonderful movies provided by Eric Karkoschka, and I encourage you to spend some time looking through them. The first one basically is shows the images as the descent occurred in sort of a forward-looking direction, eastward-looking direction. The second movie is designed to show you the spacecraft orientation parameters, data links, parachute orientation. It's really a wonderful movie for us space cadets, if you will. I love it. It's just a wonderful way to see the complexity of the entire descent. Now, going on to the next slide, which is slide 23. Again, on the right-hand side, this is something that all of you probably saw the morning of January 15th, just the day after the encounter, and the remarkable evidence of what looks like drainage channels cutting down through the bright terrain on the right-hand side there. If you look at those channels, you'll see that they're fairly high-order dendritic patterns. In other words, they branch, and the branches branch and so forth, up to fifth and sixth order, which suggests a distributed source, meaning rainfall. In other parts of the mosaics, we see very stubby networks, suggesting perhaps spring-fed processes. So there is evidence in the data set of both rainfall and springs. And the candidate, obviously, for this is methane rain forming these. Now, the dark material in the channels is not liquid. It is, although those are stretched to make them very dark, the difference in albedo between those and the surrounding terrains is actually quite small, probably less than a factor of two, and they are not dark enough to be methane liquid. Most likely, the dark material in the floors are lags of hydrocarbons that have been washed off of the bright materials. Now, going to the next slide, we've been able, because the images are acquired as the probe descends, and we acquired images from a whole variety of directions and altitudes of the same parts of the terrain. This allows the compilation of stereographic models, and this is a digital elevation model of that region, which looks like a shoreline between the dark plains and the bright highlands. The relief shown in this model is the order of 200 meters, the lowest regions being in the dark plains, which we believe to be carved by fluids. They have scoured fabrics and that you would expect from floods across a plain like that. The next slide is an animation which some of you may have downloaded. And again, this is built up from those five stereographic models. The remarkable thing about this movie is this is vertical exaggeration has not been doctored. In other words, this is one-to-one vertical. And so the very, very rugged nature of the Bright Highlands in this small block of 3 by 5 kilometer area is actually with slopes of the order of 30 degrees, which is the angle of repose. So these terrains are extremely rugged highland areas. Going to the next slide, I want to turn now to the process by which we tried to find the landing site in the radar key 8 coverage, which is shown in the lower left corner. The red circle shows where we believe the Huygens landing site, where we believed the Huygens landing site would be. The upper left corner is is an ISS image from Cassini. The lower right corner is a VIMS image of the same region. All three of these, ISS in the upper left, the radar in the lower left, and the VIMS in the lower right, are to the same scale. That is, the top-to-bottom scale is about 300 kilometers. So our thought was it would be trivial. We'd simply identify the Disser mosaic, which is shown there in the upper right, and to scale the little inset next to it, slide it over the radar image, and eureka, we'd know the landing site. Well, it turned out when we compared, as you can see, the lower left image with the lower right or upper left, that the radar images don't resemble the visible images to a large degree. As a matter of fact, very little. If you look to the right of the red circle, about four circle diameters, you'll see a circular feature with a little tab pointing out at about 10 o'clock. If you trace that feature, you can easily see it in both the ISS and the VIMS image. So a few things do correlate, but not very many. In general, the bright materials that we see in the visible images are randomly bright and dark in the radar images. So that set us on a path to trying to figure out what does, in fact, correlate between the visible and the radar images. So the next slide, we'll show the T8 coverage. You see where the Huygens landing site is there. And in the T8 coverage, we saw enormous sand seas. Ralph Lorenz et al. Have published a paper in Science recently describing these very, very ubiquitous what look like longitudinal sand dunes that drape the many parts of the equatorial regions. So these typically are 10 kilometers spacing crest to crest, and they run for hundreds of kilometers in cases. For the most part, you can see that they are sweep around and are interrupted, deflected by the bright materials, which we believe to be bright hills or mounds in the data. So coming back now, which is slide 29, let's start looking at a little more at the correlations between the radar properties in the upper left. And remember the crater Sinlap I mentioned early on that we saw in the T3 coverage. You can see in the lower left a VIMS color composite in which blue is set to 1.3 microns, green 1.6, and red 2.0 microns. These are three methane bands. And let's look at the next slide, which shows the windows through the absorbing gases. And there are basically the primary absorber in the atmosphere is methane, CH4. And although nitrogen, which is the primary atmospheric gas, the carrier gas, and a small amount of carbon monoxide also are absorbers. I've lettered the three bands I just mentioned in the VIMS. 1.3, 1.6, and 2.0 microns are lettered blue, green, and red in that diagram. So those are the windows that we're looking through. So the next slide returns to the composite, VIMS composite. And if you look now, you'll see that the dark materials in VIMS in the lower left corner are broken into two units that we'll call dark brown and dark blue. The bright units in this image don't show a lot of discriminability, but we've been able to find spectral discriminability in them as well. So what is the dark brown and dark blue possibly related to? The next slide shows an enlargement of the Sinlap crater region, and you'll see that to the outer margin of this large bright radar bright region around the crater that's probably associated with the ejecta blanket and may be associated with a cloud that was windswept by the by the atmosphere during the ejection of material from the surface, this big parabolic form. Outside that margin, you see a pervasive set of these dark tiger scratch sand dunes. We found that throughout the equatorial region, the dark sand dunes seen in the radar correlate one-to-one with the dark brown unit that we saw earlier on. So going to the next slide, which is a single VIMS cube, you can see that dark brown unit wrapping around Sinlap, which is in the upper top margin on the right side of that crater. So going now, the next slide shows what might be causing this distinction of dark brown and dark blue. Water ice, which is we're now looking at slide 34. Water ice, this is a spectrum of water ice shown in black. It's 50 micron grains of water ice provided by Bob Brown, who is the PI of the VIMS team, at 120 Kelvin. And you can see that water ice has strong absorption bands at 1.6 and 2 microns. And if you look at the dark blue and the dark brown units, which are shown there, you can see the dark blue actually reverses its brightness from 1.3 to 2 microns relative to the dark brown unit in that slide. The suggestion is that the dark brown units have less water ice than the dark blue units, which may be dominated by water ice. Going on to the next slide, which is a three-dimensional model for those of you that have downloaded it, in which a cluster diagram is presented in 1.3, 1.6, and 2 microns. And what you'll see when you look at that movie is that the cluster in that is breaking apart these bright and dark units is extremely flat in three-dimensional space, suggesting that there are only three components involved in this model. The next slide, which is slide 36, shows those components mapped onto the surface. This has been interpreted if water ice is controlling the 1.6 and 2.0 micron features, and bright and dark tholins are controlling basically the brightness away from the origin in that cluster, 3D cluster. And so the interpretation is that the very dark blue in those units, which correlate now with the sand dunes, are the dark, dry tholins. So let's go back now, slide 37, and returning to try to interpret where the distant landing site is. So we've concluded that the dark sand dunes ought to be visible in both VIMS and in DISR and ISS and in radar. So let's go to the next time step, and you can see now an enlargement of the radar image from T8. The red circle is where we believe, based on navigation, that the Huygens landing site should be. And you can see that north of the landing site, there are a few dark isolated dune streamers. Those are about 30 kilometers to the north. And in fact, a young scientist at U of A, Jason Perry, actually pointed these out early on. And the side, remember, the side-looking imager on DISR looks out toward the horizon from about 45 degrees below the horizon up to the horizon. And so the side-looking imager ought to be able to see those individual dunes. So going to the next time step, which is 39, we're now zooming in on those streamers. The two of interest are just above center, about a fifth of the slide, and the next slide shows mapping the side-looking imager from DISR onto this radar image, two of the images. Next slide, we add another image. And remember I said that these images were acquired as triplets, in which a side-looking imager, a medium-resolution imager, and a high-resolution imager pictures were acquired as a triplet. So these are glued together. And as many of you know, we lost a lot of the DISR coverage owing to a transmission mistake made in coding the sequences. And so we lost the medium resolution imager in this case. However, because the side-looking imager and the high-resolution imager are locked together, we can navigate and control the side-looking imager, and that automatically places the high-resolution imager in the right place in that image. So going on to slide 42, we add another one, which is a side-looking imager with a high-resolution imager, yet another one in slide 43. And finally, we can tie the mosaic onto the radar coverage. And so it was owing to the fact that the sand dunes, these dark sand dunes, would be visible both in radar and in all three of the optical instruments that allowed us to do this navigation of the landing site. And finally, slide 45 shows an enlargement, and 46 we remove the mosaic. There's not a whole lot there. You can barely see the edge of the bright highlands, but if you you can see the difficulty in just taking the DISR mosaic and arbitrarily pasting it on the place. We now believe that the DISR landing site is probably, or the Huygens landing site is probably located to about 5 to 10 kilometers, probably closer to 5. So now going on to the next slide, which is a word slide, the summary of the VIMS and radar correlations. These dark longitudinal dunes clearly correlate with this dark brown unit seen in VIMS and believed to be high in dark solen and poor in water ice relative to the other materials. That makes these dark sand dunes granules of dark solen that are being saltated across the surface. Also, Huygens landed in a region in the bright regions and dark blue units, so there were no sand dunes in the immediate vicinity of the Huygens landing site. The nearest sand dunes were about 30 kilometers to the north. So we would expect the materials at the Huygens landing site to be those which are corresponding to the dark blue unit, which we believe to be solens that are richer in water ice. And in fact, the DISR infrared spectrometer data published by Tomasco et al. Suggests water ice present in the surface materials. So at least we're beginning to sort out one or two of the units on the surface. And coming to the next slide, which is slide 49, Titan, as I mentioned early in the talk, Titan's geology is looking like a lexicon out of a geological textbook. We see evidence for volcanic processes, faulting and tectonism, pluvial processes, that's P-L-U-V-I-A-L, which means rainfall, and carving of dendritic channels. We see things that look like spring-fed processes. We see volcanic pancake domes suggesting volcanic processes. So, but until the end of July, we had not seen anything that convinced us that we were actually seeing liquids on the surface. Now, coming back, so slide 50 is a ISS image. It's actually an animation of several images showing a kidney-shaped feature near the south polar region that the imaging system, Carolyn Porco is the PI, imaged about a year ago now. And this large, dark-shaped feature is actually the size of Lake Ontario, and the ISS team suggested this might be a lake, although because the difficulty in seeing through the atmosphere and getting a good measure at the surface albedo and so forth, it was difficult to certify. So let's come now to the next slide, which shows all of the radar coverages with the addition of T-16 that was acquired in late July. And this is the one that recently you've seen from the radar team suggests we may in fact now be seeing these methane or methane-ethane lakes up in the very high latitudes. The darkest of these, going to the next slide, which is slide 52, occur at the very highest latitude of this path. And these, if you looked at these in a histogram, you'd see that the darkest parts of these bodies that look like lake-like features are very, very dark. The radar team is working now to analyze how dark these really are and if the case really can be made that we're seeing liquids, but the preliminary indication is that they are dark and quite likely liquids. They're much darker than anything we've seen elsewhere, particularly in the equatorial and mid-latitude regions. Notice that in the lower tier, which is a part of the path, and I believe that's to the right-hand side, you see many disconnected little lakes, and that suggests that perhaps the intersection of a rough surface with a methane water table, as it were, sort of like a slump in which the water table intersects the surface. The upper images show stubby drainages that go in places, and a lot of these are in very deep circular depressions or quasi-circular depressions. These may in fact be calderas that are filled with fluids. So perhaps rain, perhaps tectonic volcanic control of the depressions, and perhaps the subsurface is saturated and the water table or methane table basically intercepts the surface. More to come on that. The radar team's busy analyzing the results and writing these up for publication. But in T19, we after seeing the T16 coverage, we elected to move the T19 coverage. We have the choice of either looking to the right or to the left of the spacecraft, to the right or left of the ground track. And we elected to look at high latitude with T19, which will be coming up in early October. And you can see that it will perhaps intercept a few of the, quote, lakes that we're seeing at very high latitude in T16. If that's the case, one of the things that we'll be looking for is changes in pattern. These lakes may actually have wind ripples on them, and if those were to change in form, that would certainly be another piece of evidence. And the other question is whether or not these lakes, quote unquote, that appear to be pervasive above 70 north are even more abundant at higher latitudes where T19 will cover. So stay tuned for that. And so in summary, for a planetary object that I, for one, expected to find the most bizarre and new processes, unimagined processes, the more we look at it, the more it looks like processes that we see in geomorphology and geological settings on the Earth, albeit that the chemistry and the temperature are shifted enormously. And so questions, are these really lakes? Where is the rain occurring? Is it occurring in the polar regions? Is that why we see evidence of the lakes at high latitudes? Will there be are there monsoonal seasons as the sun moves from latitude to latitude? As you know, Titan has seasons like the Earth and Mars, owing to its tilt of its rotation axis relative to the sun. Currently, the sun is at in the southern mid-latitudes in about 2010. It'll cross the equator and move north, and we'll be looking to see if the weather patterns change and we see evidence of rain elsewhere on the planet. So thank you very much.
Do we have any questions?
Where can we find the animations he mentioned?
Those are on the password-protected site for the Charm Telecon, and in the original email that you got, there's all the contact information to get to that site is at the bottom.
Mute off.
Yes, hello. I have some questions. Ken Kramer. You mentioned, let's see, a T-16. Can you make any estimate of how deep these lakes may be?
How deep they may be?
Yeah.
It's possible that in some places we're seeing where the lakes don't look as dark as they seem to vary in their darkness, Ken. It's possible that we're actually seeing the radar reflecting off the floor of the channel of the bottom of the lake, because methane could be quite transparent to the radar. In those cases, it might be several tens of meters deep. In the very darkest parts, they might be 100 meters deep. But again, this will await further analysis, and we have experts on the radar team looking at the radar properties that are expected. But one of the suggestions is that we're actually seeing reflections from the floors of some of these lakes, which is causing variations in their appearance.
That's really helpful, yeah. And I'm looking at this big lake-like feature that you're saying that has a channel on the top right. So you're saying that little squiggle is the bottom. Wow.
Yeah. If you actually look at that image that's two pieces of the swath, one above the other, the darkest parts are the lake in the upper left corner. Then there's a lake that's kind of in the middle of that swath. It's kind of irregular shape with rounded margins. It has a very dark spot in it. And then the upper right lake, you actually see a dark part in the largest lake, a dark part sort of left of center.
Yes.
But then you see what look like channels.
That's what I'm talking about, exactly.
So one of the notions is that you're actually looking at the floor through the liquid.
And the brighter areas are they they're higher in elevation, obviously, I guess, right?
Yeah, and those vary from I suspect there's a combination of some of these bright materials are water ice, the things that are bright. I didn't get into that, but we see variations in their infrared properties in the VIMS data, suggesting some of these bright areas are water ice, perhaps cleansed by the rain, and others may be bright tholin. So one idea is that perhaps the tholin, which is snowing out of the atmosphere, may start out as bright material, coat the surface, and then as it's moved and washed and blown around, it aggregates into coarser and coarser particles that become dark. This is similar to processes that occur on Mars as well.
And these lakes, there is some question in your mind then as to whether these actually are lakes.
I'll give them 90%.
90%, okay.
But there are a lot more, there are folks on the team which are less and more conservative. So we're really excited about getting this new coverage in early October. As a matter of fact, it's right adjacent to the DPS. So we may be able to have something available.
Yeah, because the public press release is coming out like this is like greater than 99% chance that this is a leak. So, okay, but you're still a little bit hesitant.
Yeah, well, you know how things work with the press.
Right.
There's a tendency to convert qualifiers to not caveats to be deleted.
Right. And you think these, if they are, let's assume they are, like, this is mostly methane and maybe just a little bit of ethane, is that right?
sorry, that I think that we don't have any direct evidence, although we know that ethane has to be there because it's generated in the photochemical process, and we know it'll be immiscible. I don't know how much ethane was detected in the GCMS or whether that's been refined, but most of what was seen was methane as far as the hydrocarbon.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking, because I asked this question. They haven't found much ethane in the GCMS, is my understanding from one of these other telecoms.
I think that's the case. But I think Hunter is going to do this in a month. Is that right, Trina?
Yes. In fact, our very next Charm Telecon is all about Titan's atmosphere.
So ask him that question and ask him where the ethane went.
If these are not lakes, what could they be?
They could be solid. They'd have to be very, very smooth for a 2-centimeter radar to be reflected away like a mirror.
Could they be frozen lakes, Larry?
Well, frozen what is the problem? More likely, they'd be lakes that maybe were very flat, and the liquid basically retreated to the subsurface. I suppose that they were some sort of volcanic eruption of a material that was extremely fluid and formed a surface that could be like an ice sheet. That's conceivable, but you know, the easiest thing for them to be is liquid methane. Also, the fact that they're so highly concentrated in this latitude ring north of 70 degrees doesn't suggest to me that they're, a volcanic process, but some sort of natural process related to the atmosphere, a la rain in the polar regions. As a matter of fact, it's been suggested that the polar regions may well be experiencing a lot of rainfall now.
What's your opinion about this rainfall now? The latest that I've read is that it could be a mist coming down.
Right. Those are a couple papers that came out just the end of July in Nature, was it?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I think they were talking about mist everywhere. One of the things that the DISR data has shown is that the tholen particles, as they fall through the atmosphere, may change their optical properties and become very shiny toward the bottom. And so perhaps the stuff is nucleating on them and you're forming icy coatings. But as far as rain, I don't... The problem all along is finding direct evidence for liquid, whether it's rain or on the surface in the form of lakes. What do you actually look for? And everything we've come up with, you can find alternative explanations, although I think the alternative explanations for the very, very high latitude concentration of these lake-like features is... what makes me think that it's 90-10 that they are liquid.
Well, to follow up on that, what would a ripple look like if that's what you're looking for?
A ripple, like a wind ripple?
A water ripple, right? That's what you're looking for, maybe a wave?
Well, the ripples on the surface would be ripples on the surface of the methane liquid.
That's what I'm talking about. What would they look like?
Look like a deviation where instead of seeing the really dark, you start to see, because the waves are facing the spacecraft, and the radar would come to right, some small fraction would come directly back. So you see these in Earth orbital radar of places in the oceans and the Mediterranean and so forth, in which you see all kinds of patterns which are related to ripples and wind wakes. And so the question is, can we take some images with the radar in October of the same lakes and see if, in fact, the patterns have changed. So, well, Trina?
You got time for a few more questions?
Sure.
Great. Can we go to slide 11, which was TA pass? Okay. On the right-hand side. I think you said you might come back to this. Now, in light of the T16 pass, these dark areas, we see these really dark, we see these dark, similar kind of dark areas. What are you're thinking about them? Are they possible?
Oh, on the lower right corner, the thing you see, the cap? Where is that what we're looking at, slide 11?
Yes, on the lower right, exactly.
If you, as a matter of fact, we did this in the T16 pass, and we basically made a histogram of the brightness variations within the entire pass. And you basically see the very bright materials as a mode, sort of the, and the very dark lake-like things at the poles as a mode right against the floor of the signal. And then you see variations of dark materials, which are sort of mid-range. Well, this set of data here is fairly mid-range. In other words, they've been stretched so that the dark materials, these are the dark materials in this image, but they are very, very much brighter than the dark lakes in T16.
Oh, they are. So,
yep. So one of the things that I'm hoping we'll include in the radar paper on this is a set of images that are all stretched the same.
Yeah, right.
So you can really see that effect. And, you know, it's like images of the Martian polar regions. Everybody stretches them so hard that things that vary in albedo by 2% from one another look black and white. And we're taking advantage of the fact that these cameras have extremely high signal and noise, but they can be very misleading if they're just auto-stretched.
Yeah, you're fooling yourself, basically.
Yeah. So I think it'd be really good if we can get a set of these radar passes in which they're sort of stacked side by side. They're all stretched identically.
Hey, Larry, this is Anita.
Hey.
Is there any chance of any colorization or anything to help people interpret these a little better?
There are some tricks. This is getting away from my my field, so I'm going to hesitate to go there. I'm not sure the data are there, but by looking at different angles of reflection off of these surfaces, there may be a way to use the radar to get a better handle of sort of the reflection as a function of emission angle from these things. Incidence and emission angle, if you will. So by getting all of the data that we get from T16 and T19, we may be able to see more than find the optical properties or radar properties. But the experts on the team will work that problem.
Who would that be?
People like Phil Callahan, Brian Stiles, those folks.
Okay. On that slide 11, on the left, it looks like a circular structure. Is that a caldera, do you think? And do you have an estimate of the...
I think it's actually a raised... we see those on Venus, and they're called pancake domes.
Uh-huh.
So if you sort of imagine a flapjack laying on the table, the notion is that they're produced by a viscous eruption that just oozes out. Now, we don't have any direct evidence on the topography other than the radar shading around the margin. But in the case of Venus, they're clearly standing up above the surface. It looked just like this.
And do you have a diameter estimate on that one?
Typically the radar flaws are about 150 kilometers wide in their narrow part. So that one's probably like that.
Takes some time to get to interpret these, doesn't it?
But that's kind of a good number to memorize, sort of that the width of a radar swath is about 200.
Right, and they go up to like 400 toward the ends.
Right, and the length is like 1,000 or something.
They're really long. Really? You know, and it's been really exciting because the radar, like all the instruments on Cassini, has worked so well. We've been able to get data from higher and higher altitudes and increase the coverage. And that's been really fortunate. So.
Do we have any other questions?
Yeah. Can I ask about slides 19 and 20, please?
Sure.
Okay, let's look at slide 20 first. The height there, that's kilometers, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and in the lower axis, is that similar? Each one of those is about, those tick marks, about a half kilometer or so?
Wow.
See, because I'm looking at your slide 19 and 20, and 19 looks like it's really traveled a long distance.
Right.
But when I look at 20, it doesn't look all that long to this.
I'll tell you what, the right thing to look at is Nature, December 8th, 2005,
mm-hmm.
Tomasco et al., and I think Bashar Riff put in a model in Figure 2 that shows the actual, actually if you look in Figure 1, you can see the, you have to use a microscope, but the reversal, the total distance of the scale on the bottom, in that I'd have to look it up, but it's more like a kilometer on the full side of those things marked east and north.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking exactly it's more than...
What happened is the, you know, the wind speeds dropped to like a half a meter a second. Total distance that the probe traveled back on itself was only the order of a kilometer, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you need to view that as sort of schematic. Yeah, it looks like maybe 2 kilometers, but not very far.
Are there, let's see, to go to that kidney-shaped feature in slide 50, are we going to be looking at that again in another pass to get some more data on whether that may or may not be a lake?
Probably not until the extended mission. Trina, do you know anything about that?
Let me look to see.
I thought we had a radar pass
near there, T-39, but I'm not positive.
I don't think there's anything in the southern...
No, yeah. I don't see anything that's gonna hit that lake, but it does get into the area.
Yeah, the we're really hoping that in the extended mission that we can get into some really neat... orbital configurations that will allow us to get more coverage in the polar regions.
So did I understand you right? There's not going to be any radar then in the south?
I don't...
No, we have a few. We had T7 we had that went pretty far south, but we lost half of that. Then T39 goes even further south than that. And then we have a little bit of T36 that gets right down there and a little bit of T41.
So there may be some radar passes at the same latitude as what we see in slide 50 then.
You know, like T16 and T19?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that we have anything like that, but Trina's looking at the map.
Yeah, you were talking about the South Pole, was that
yes,
right, the
I'm
question?
Talking about the South, right.
Yeah. Yeah, the numbers that I listed were for the South Pole. We do also have some more northern passes. T19 is a good example. And then we have a series, sort of T23, T28, T29, T30. Those are all North Pole passes.
And overall,
similar to T16.
You're looking for about 40% coverage with the radar in the...
Oh, no, 20 in the prime mission currently.
Oh, 20.
Yeah.
We may get a little more than that. On the other hand, you know, we have lost pieces of passes owing to, you know, things that happen. The real hope is the extended mission is going to give us a
maybe another 10% or more.
Yeah, we might get up to 30%, 35%.
Extended mission, maybe.
More than that.
The one thing we do know is that we know at the end of the Cassini mission, we will not, you know, we will not have it covered. So we have to go back.
Hey, what's your opinion? Oh, this brings up a great question about follow-on missions to Europa or Titan. Or what about a Titan balloon?
The Titan balloon is, well, okay, Europa's exciting, but extremely difficult because of the radiation environment and so forth, right? And also, if you're really, whereas Titan is maybe one of the easiest things to get to in that sense. And so, you know, if you wanted to find something that's easy versus difficult, if they both had identical scientific merit, let's just say that they do, so we won't argue among the Europeans and the Titans, then Titan certainly is a lot easier.
Yeah,
so what year would you think, Larry, that we might be back at Titan if you had to, you know, put a bet down? With your vast experience and knowledge.
Oh, well, it kind of depends on what happens in politics in the next few years. But maybe 2015.
And you do it within the Discovery program, or do you need a much more expensive?
I think that it's going to require a flagship mission. Yeah.
This is interesting because I guess NASA has always promoted, or the scientists, Europa as the place to go, until your colleague Jonathan Lewin.
Well, there was a caveat when we started looking at Titan, Europa, and other targets back 6 years ago, and the answer was, let's wait until Cassini before we try to make that decision. So we now have Cassini. So what do you think?
Oh, I think we should go to both, actually. I'm a chemist myself, and I think they're both fantastic.
All right, well, that's a very politic answer.
No, well, the reason is because water. I mean, liquid water and life, you know, you got a better chance with Europa.
Yeah, that's true.
But I understand that there's a radiation problem, and can you even get through the ice? You know, it's a couple of kilometers, so that's a real question, whether you could do that.
Yeah.
Whereas I think I agree that the balloon going to Titan and the way you've presented it is very attractive, and from a chemical standpoint, it's fantastic. We're not going to find life at Titan, I would guess, but a lot of interesting chemistry.
Yep.
Oh, man, I'd like to go to both, actually. Plus Ceres would be another one.
Sure.
Or Enceladus, for that matter.
Oh, Enceladus is exciting.
I'm for all of them. Do we have any more questions?
Hey, I got one last question about slide 36.
Okay.
I don't understand. What is the difference between the blue and the green?
Okay. Do you have... in slide 35 is an animation.
Yeah.
Cluster something.
Right.
So basically what that is if you play that animation, you'll see that triangle has three end members: water, ice, dark solen, bright solen, and everything lies on a sheet. So what I basically did there is I assigned that to a trinary diagram in which water ice is red in this model. The dark solen is blue, and the bright solen is green. So where you see red and blue, you're going to see magenta or purple, and so that would be dark materials that are water rich.
The dark materials are water rich. Oh, I see. And the
purple
bright materials
magenta.
Are water poor then?
Then the blue materials would be water poor.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to.
Okay, and then the green materials would be bright materials that are water poor.
Green is water. Let me just write this down. Green
is bright. That's water poor.
And the blue is water rich.
Blue is water poor.
Water poor.
So blue and green are basically the dark solen and the bright solen without with less water. Everything probably has water ice in it, by the way, so we're talking about degrees.
So, well, that's what I'm getting at. What is the difference between the dark zone and the bright zone?
Probably grain size.
Ah, just grain size.
Or chemistry. I mean, the solens, the stuff that folks have generated all the way back to Carney and Sagan, there are a variety of solens you can generate. Some of them are dark, some of them are bright. The fine-grain stuff may be the bright solen. My model is that it starts out as bright, fine-grained. It's processed on the surface. It coagulates into larger and larger grains and that become darker. And then finally, because their scattering is inhibited, and finally they saltate. So that's just a mental model. So the stuff that's orange would be bright material that's got water, more water in it, and the purple stuff would be dark material that has more water in it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And this is just a model.
I understand the difference. I didn't quite understand the difference.
Model.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
Could you explain why solens, they don't exist on Earth and how they're actually created experimentally, like you had just referred to Carl Sagan's early experiments?
They're created by mixing methane and nitrogen gas and putting them in a plasma chamber and electrocuting them. That's the original. And then there's more recent papers. I think Imanaka and the folks at Ames have done more recent work. But basically, it's due to the fact there's abundant methane exposed to solar UV at the top of the atmosphere. And the methane just is photochemically with nitrogen as well. CH4 is dismembered, and then C2H2 from forming the ethane and C2H6, the ethane, C2H2, acetylene, propane, all these heavier things. And finally, they coagulate into bigger, more complex hydrocarbons. And this is not my field, but I could certainly get you a long list of literature on the subject. This would be a real good question for Hunter next month. Because he understands the chemistry of the upper atmosphere better than anybody.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any final questions?
Could I ask a Mars question?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to the North Pole. What's your opinion about where we're going to find life on Mars? Is it better there, or should we... If we could direct the Mars Science Lab there, or better at the equatorial regions, where I guess it's planned for.
You mean polar versus equatorial?
Yeah.
Well, the polar regions would be a lot of fun because of the history that's got to be held in the polar layers of ices. But it's probably mostly modern geological history, the last 100 million years or less. The equatorial regions are going to give us evidence back to 2 and 3 billion years ago, and that may be the period in which Mars was warm, wet, and may actually be more interesting from that perspective, from the life perspective. So I guess here's the answer again, is do both.
Okay, well, Larry, we'd like to thank you very much today for taking the time out of your schedule to talk to the Charm Telecon. We really appreciate it. We've had a really nice series of these talks over the last couple of years, and they all go on this audio recording that we have several hundred people download, and we've gotten a lot of very good feedback. So we really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Hey, Trina, can I make a plug here?
Sure.
For the Division for Planetary Sciences meeting is one of the two top... planetary science meetings that are held every year, and it will be in Pasadena, California this year, October 8 to 13, and we are planning some solar system seminars, especially for faculty and their students just locally, and then we're hoping to also make it available as an online course that people can take either fall or spring semester online. So I can send out information about that if anybody is interested in actually coming to DPS. Give me a ring, and we'll see if we can get you in without having to pay registration.
Sounds good. And this was Anita, right?
Yes, Anita Soas at JTL.
And then our Charm Telecon for next month, as Larry's already alluded to, is Dr. Hunter Wade. He is a principal investigator for the ion and neutral mass spectrometer and also an expert on Titan's atmosphere. And he'll be giving us the talk. The telecon will be on Titan's atmosphere and hopefully some of the history of how our understanding of Titan's atmosphere has changed, which is it's changed quite a bit during just the Cassini mission itself. We've actually had to change the reference trajectory of the spacecraft a couple of times based on newer and better understanding of Titan's atmosphere. So that's going to be a terrific talk. That'll be next month, the last Tuesday of the month, as always, at 11 a.m. Pacific time, and that will be September 26th. And with that, we'll let everybody go. Have a great week.
Thank you. That was excellent.
Mute off.
Anita, are you still there?